from the news centre at 5. 17 fishermen and a company that ran a former fish processing factory have been fined nearly £1 million in one of Scotland's biggest fishing scams. They admitted to making illegal landings of mackerel and herring worth nearly £48 million. Officials found scales used to weigh the fish that they caught had been manipulated to provide false weights. Our reporter Jane Chilton is at Glasgow High Court.
The relation of earnings to the amount of fish that they admitted to landing just didn't add up, and the inspectors went in, and that's when they found these anomalies and the very sophisticated systems that they set up to avoid the true catch figures being discovered.
The owner of a furniture store destroyed during last year's riots in London says it's momentous that someone has admitted to setting fire to it. 33-year-old Gordon Thompson has pleaded guilty to arson. The shop's owner, Trevor Reeves, described the last 6 months as traumatic and devastating.
We can now look forward to rebuilding our business in our remaining store and, with the support of the community, hopefully live and trade in a better, more tolerant and responsible society.
A pub landlady has won a legal battle to overturn her conviction for using foreign decoders to show Premier League football matches. Karen Murphy from Portsmouth paid a Greek broadcaster, less than Sky, for exactly the same footage. The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has warned Syria's government that it will have more blood on its hands if it doesn't comply with demands for a ceasefire. At a conference in Tunisia, she also announced a $10 million aid package for humanitarian efforts. There are fears that we could be slipping back into recession. Official figures show growth for the final quarter of last year, and its original calculation of a 0.2% decline is unchanged. And X Factor producers have decided to change the rules, allowing contestants to audition who've already got managers. Gary Barlow, who's in talks to return to the show, let it slip that the show will be open to all. That's the latest. I'm Chris
Giles.
Bristol
Community FM 93.2.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is MEP for the UK Independence Party, William Dartmouth.
Good afternoon.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the misdiagnosis scandal at the University Hospitals Bristol NHS Trust, that's mainly the BRI to you and I, but rather than investigate and improve, there are some who say the trust is ruled from the top by a cover-up culture. And postponed from last week, Bill Gates is pouring money into geoengineering to prepare for climate change. But what exactly does Bill need earthquake bombs for? Also, Islamic think tank Global Vision 2000 believes the old colonial system has been replaced by a secretive global financial cartel, which has the same effect, stripping small nations of their natural resources. We examine possible economic motives for the wars on Iraq, Libya and Syria with this Islamic think tank. Plus, another look at who really runs the world examines the dangers of combined power of the media and the police when, as in the phone hacking scandal, it turns criminal. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 9 degrees Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 11 Celsius, some hazy sunshine on Saturday and sunnier on Sunday. Next week, highs of 11 Celsius cloudy with some rain at the beginning of the week, sunnier and cooler towards the end of the week. Next weekend, that's the 3rd and 4th of March, highs of 5 degrees Celsius, but sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests, and joining me is MEP for the UK Independence Party, William Dartmouth. Hi, William. Welcome to Drive Time.
Yeah, hi.
First of all, I know you're involved a bit with the controversy about these European arrest warrants. So could you just explain those a bit?
Yes.
What is in a European arrest warrant?
Well, I basically got involved in this because two constituents, Michael Turner and Jason McColdrick, were accused by the Hungarian authorities of fraud, a fraud that amounted to about £18,000. The Hungarian authorities served a European arrest warrant on them. They were then carted off by Hungarian special forces from Heathrow, and then they then served
Sorry, they were actually, arrested and in Britain by the British police or by these special forces?
They were arrested by the British police and then handed over to Hungarian special forces at Heathrow.
So this is to the Hungarian army, not only the army, but their...
I wasn't actually there at that time, yeah. but they're clear that they were special forces. And then they were then put into a former KGB prison in Budapest, which I actually visited. Now, the point I would make is that... they were simply put in prison before trial. Now, when I visited the Hungarian authorities, I spoke to the prosecutor. I remember it so well. I sat in the prosecutor's office. I asked the question, how long could they be in the prison before the case comes to trial? And the Hungarian authorities treated me with exemplary courtesy, and I was there in the office, and I was sitting sipping a cup of coffee, and the prosecutor said they can be in the prison for up to 4 years, and basically that is the point. Under the European arrest warrant, people can be just put into trial while evidence is gathered. And the fact of the matter is that this was pushed through all the three establishment parties. Labour, Conservative and Liberal Democrats all voted in favour of it, and they voted in favour of it because of the myth that the legal systems in other countries, in other European countries, are the same as what they are in England. It's just completely untrue.
Something seems a bit back to front here, in that you're saying there that someone is arrested whilst evidence is being gathered.
Exactly. I mean, for us here in the UK, it's almost impossible to get one's head around it. But that is the system which applies in Hungary, and indeed in most continental European countries. And everybody is vulnerable. Everybody is at risk under this thing, and it is a bit of an irony that this was pushed through by the Liberal Democrats, the so-called party of civil liberties. Like most people, I didn't know anything about this until I came across this case. Now, the trial is taking after 114 days, after a lot of pressure put on, a tiny bit by me, an awful lot by the BBC, and an awful lot by other people making representations. Michael and Jason were released after 114 days in remand prison, and it's now something like 6 or 7 years after the original. The offence of which they're accused of, and they're actually going to trial on February the 29th. Now, I'm going to Budapest on Tuesday simply to be an observer of that trial, but I must make the point that where the European arrest warrant is so insidious is that a British judge can no longer look at the primary... There used to be something called extradition, which meant that somebody brought a case against, I say you, let's say it's me, against me. It goes before a British judge. The British judge evaluates the primary evidence and says, and then comes to a conclusion about whether what is alleged is strong enough to warrant extradition or not. Now what happens is that extradition has gone. It's, as far as the European arrest warrant is concerned, it's simply a box-ticking exercise. The papers are stamped. Are they all in order? Yes, they are. And then they're carted off to wherever. And they go under what is normally an entirely different legal system. And, as I said, it's almost impossible to get our heads around, but Michael and Jason could have been in that prison for up to 4 years without coming to trial.
So have they actually been... So the trial still hasn't quite taken place, but have they actually been charged? Because we remember Julian Assange, who's being charged with rape, I believe, over in Scandinavia, hasn't actually even been charged. I mean, this sounds incredible that you can be actually arrested for something in another country and extradited before the evidence has even been gathered enough to convince a legal professional that you should be charged with an offence.
Yes, and you can also be carted off under the European arrest warrant for something which is not a crime in the country, in your own country. I mean, you actually mentioned Julian Assange. Well, what Julian Assange is accused of is not a crime in the UK, for example. And very, very few people know about it. And I've got to pay tribute to that Sunday Telegraph journalist. He was actually run spreads on this. And unfortunately, many people objected to this at the time. Many lawyers objected to this at the time. But all these objections were all dismissed because they said, you know, you're all just being Eurosceptic, and we're building this great integrated European superstate, and everything's the same, and everybody's going to live happily ever afterwards. And that is not the case. So now, out of all the, there are many, many, many anomalies, many, 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 many things which adversely affect Britain and Britain and the British people because of our continuing membership of the European Union.
But I mean, isn't this inevitable?
I think just about the worst is the European arrest warrant because that affects our basic liberties.
But isn't this inevitable in a Europe, in an EU? Well, although we did have a referendum to go into something called the common market, it's now transmogrified into something else called the EU. But if we're going to have an EU with a president and with a commission, and there is at least a kind of political union going on, surely this kind of international arrest warrant is inevitable, isn't it?
Well, I mean, there have been international arrest warrants before, but the entire point... But I mean, the entire point is that there's now no safeguard against extradition, and the Julian Assange example is a very, very good one. Now, there's even a worse example of that. There's the Siminut case, which is a chap who's 18 who actually lives in London, is a constituent of my colleague Gerard Batten. He was accused of being involved in a bar fight in Greece where somebody died. He was imprisoned in appalling circumstances in a Greek prison, and after a year, the Greek authorities admitted, and thank God that they did, that it was all a case of mistaken identity. But I mean, you say that people have signed up to political union.
Well, no, I think they that. No, no, I didn't say that.
And I'm
they
just,
signed up
and
to
I'm
the common market, which is becoming slowly a political union.
Well, not so slowly, more and more rapidly. And I mean, what we in our party have asked for is that we have asked for an immediate suspension of the European arrest warrant preparatory to withdrawing from the EAW completely. And actually, there's a bit of an irony here. I'd like to say something about the European Court of Human Rights. Mr. Abu Qatada, and I'm sure I've mispronounced his name.
No, you did it quite well, actually.
Is deemed to be a danger to the public. That is the considered view of the Home Secretary and the British Security Services. But we can't deport him. We can't deport him because the judgment of the European, successive judgments of the European Court of Human Rights doesn't permit us to do so. So even though he's a danger to the public. So we're in the
allegedly, because actually statements by the Home Secretary and by MI5, you know, they can be notoriously sort of creepy behind the scenes, MI5. If a statement's made by those two, it doesn't mean a hill of beans, does it? Actually, it needs to be something which is, again, put before a judge, and
You use your words with great care. So let me use my words with great care too, which is allegedly. Anyway, there is very significant grounds for deportation, but he can't be deported. And the reason he can't be deported is not because the allegations don't stack up. The reason he can't be deported is because of his human rights. So we're therefore in the ludicrous position, as laid down by the European Court of Human Rights. We're therefore in the ludicrous position that we can't protect our own people from being deported. But at the same time...
Extradited, yeah.
Well, carted off. I prefer to use the word carted off.
Okay.
Carted off. Whereas at the same time, we can't protect us. We aren't allowed to deport people who are perceived as being a danger. And, of course, this is being clarified even further by the case of Mr. Tappin today. I mean, I watched the news this morning, not least because I knew I was going to appear on your programme, but with great care. And Mr. Tappin has said, I have fewer human rights than Abu Qatada does, who is a suspected terrorist.
Now, Mr. Tappin is the chap who's being extradited to the United States.
Mr. Tappin is the person who's being extradited to the United States. And that is because there's another one-sided extradition treaty. And all these things are completely wrong. These are completely wrong. I just say, in the context of Mr. Tappin, does the name Abu Hamza mean anything to you? Who's the chap with the one arm? Well, of course, guess what? he's been successfully putting off his extradition to the United States for something like 3 years, whereas Mr. Tappan has been carted off to the United States in about 3 months flat. I was always brought up with the concept that an Englishman's home is his castle, and once you're in England, that you were safe, and that we have a superior legal system. And these our own people are being thrown to the wolves to other legal systems, which simply just don't have the same respect for the rights of the individual and human rights in the fullest sense of the word. That our system does.
But we're dealing with three quite different cases here with these. I mean, this guy,
Tapping, and that's what makes it very interesting.
Yeah. But this guy, Mr. Tapping, who is supposedly been supplying missile parts to the Iranians, this is a story which gets a lot of traction in the news at the moment because of all the tensions to do with Iran.
It's a story today.
And one does wonder sometimes whether there is a sort of picking and choosing amongst the judiciary and legal profession as to which of these cases are important ones which need to proceed and which ones need to be sort of kicked into touch.
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, Abu Hamza's I was just reminded of it today. Abu Hamza's extradition seems to be completely kicked into touch. I mean, you don't hear anything about it. I dare say he's got posses of human rights lawyers, which we're paying for, which is preventing this from happening. But Mr. Tappan, who's 65 now, and I read in the papers that he was the victim, or not the victim, the subject of an American government sting operation.
This is what he says, anyway.
Which is actually what he says. Well, if this is indeed true, I mean, it seems to be very, very peculiar that that British citizens are being the subject of sting operations by foreign countries. I say this, I'm extremely pro-American, and I mean, my concern is someone who's very pro-American. I lived in the United States for 8 years. I even have a degree from an American university. This kind of thing very much reduces the regard in which the United States is held by people in Britain. There does seem to be something very, very wrong here.
So, talking about FBI sting operations, I think it's a good time to bring Martin Summers in, old Labour Oxford economist. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
Oxford economist and sting operations.
Yes, right. Okay, Martin. So what about this idea of this British guy being caught in an FBI sting to do with Iranian missiles?
If you actually look at all of the cases in the US, or so-called terrorism cases, there's been a score of them, they're all sting operations, including the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993. That was a sting operation.
The
underpants bomber. Well, Kurt Haskell, who's a lawyer who was on the plane with the underpants bomber, he gave a statement to the court when he pleaded guilty. He gave a statement to the court saying, and he's a top lawyer, and his wife was on the plane, saying that he got onto the plane by taken through security without being checked at all. He didn't even have a passport, and he's given an affidavit to that. He was going to actually be brought in to on the side of the defence for the guy that was accused. So it looks as if this chap was in fact allowed on the plane and was by the FBI. But the FBI have actually captured, most of the people they've captured have been sting operations. And in 1993, the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, the FBI supplied the explosives to their mole in the organization. And he said, well, presumably you don't want me to do anything with these. They said, no, we want you to blow it up. So they did blow the building up. Six people were killed, and then they were all arrested immediately because it was an FBI plot from start to finish. And if you look at all of these terrorist cases in the US, they're all sting operations. And in fact, Abu Hamza has got a reputation for being an MI5 double agent.
Yes, but I think that my point is,
we mustn't mix up Abu Hamza with Abu Qatada, which is in the news this week.
I think my earlier point, which I would like to revert back to, is that Mr. Tappan, who is 65 and is a British citizen of some standing, it'd be an interesting question to know why the American authorities have seen fit to mount what would appear to be a very elaborate sting operation against him. I mean, he doesn't exactly seem to meet the profile of a terrorist, actually.
Well, he may meet the profile of a potential arms dealer. And if you do, operations are admissible, I think, in police operations. But you've got to be very clear what's going on, because of course the defence will argue when it comes to trial, well, actually, my client was entrapped.
I must make the point as a devotee of the novels of John Grisham, who I think I have just mispronounced his name, is it Grisham or Grisham, which I suspect some of you all did. I mean, I have a great respect for American law. However, in these circumstances, it's completely stacked against Mr. Tappan. He will not be allowed bail because he's thought to be a flight risk. which incidentally also applies to people who were arrested under the, under the European arrest warrant. He will be put into a federal prison. He'll be put in a dormitory with 100 or more other men, almost all of whom are accused of very, very serious crimes. And if he wants to defend himself, he will have to spend literally millions of dollars.
But Martin, Christopher Tappin, this guy that's going over to the US, is it too much to say, well, actually, this could be completely set up just for the news stories,
so that we are left thinking we have enemies...
Can you help me finish my sentence? We have enemies within Britain who are aiding Iran.
Well, it seems to me, obviously I don't know the detail of the actual case, but it seems to me that they want to have cases about Iran at the moment for political reasons. They want to create an atmosphere around Iran and so on and so forth. And
he's facing 35 years in prison in the United States, and he's being extradited today.
But I think to revert to my earlier point, what I'm really saying is that this is another one-sided extradition treaty, and the European arrest warrant is a one-sided extradition treaty. And the concept that an Englishman's home is his castle and that you're safe subject to British law when you're here, that's gone now.
But I mean, that's surely gone.
We're only just realising that.
But William, surely that's gone in medieval times. We're living in an international world now of internationalists. Many of the most powerful people in the world are internationalists. They don't really recognise, shall we say, the borders that we used to, particularly here in Europe. I mean, they're dissolving these borders.
Well, we can. In the context of fighting international crime, we can perfectly well, and this has always been my point, we can perfectly well cooperate with other police authorities and other jurisdictions without giving up the hard-won British liberties which go back to the days of Magna Carta. And just to give you two examples of that, Britain has been a member of Interpol since 1923. Actually, you don't hear about Interpol so much now, but I used to hear it a lot.
Martin brings it up from time to time.
And secondly, I don't normally have a huge amount to say in favour of Jack Straw and the previous Labour government, which won't surprise you, but Jack Straw produced sign up a fast-track extradition treaty with Spain, which meant that in 2003, which was significantly before the European arrest warrant came into effect, and that is why the Costa del crime is there no longer. And the answer is that we can perfectly well cooperate and have special treaties without throwing all our ancient liberties out the window and out the door. Okay. It's basically what's happening now.
Well, we're going to have a look at the Greek sign-up last Sunday and the general Greek crisis in a minute. But first, William, how do you feel it's all going with the euro and Greece? It doesn't look too good. Are the Greeks going to exit the euro, or are they just going to have another bailout? It feels almost like the IMF and the European Central Bank and these people who are negotiating with the Greek government are like loan sharks. They keep coming back and knocking on the door again and again, demanding more cash and demanding more of their infrastructure to be privatised and actually cutting spending in Greece. So what's your view as an MEP of what's been going on with the Greek euro crisis?
Well, I mean, I very much agree with the assumptions on which the question is based. I mean, this is a bailout. There was a previous bailout six months ago. This is a bailout now. Most of the money for the bailout is simply being used to pay off earlier debts, and the people who are suffering and the people who benefit from this are the bankers who lent the money, and the people who are suffering from this are the Greek people. The Labour Party and other parties talk about the austerity in this country, which is very, very worrying, but it's nothing compared to what's going on in Greece. I mean, the Greeks have got to sack over 120,000 public sector employees. And it's a comparatively small country. That would be equivalent to sacking over 800,000 public sector employees now. I mean, the fact of the matter is very, very simple. Greece has borrowed much too much money. It can't be paid back on any criteria at all. Greece should default and reinstitute the drachma. And in case there's too much shock horror at this suggestion, Greece has defaulted no less than six times since it's been an independent country. Mm. So and I mean, countries do default. It has happened. And I mean, it happens all the time. All this is doing is it's a sort of slow death. It's a slow death. And meantime, the Greek people are having to suffer the most terrible privations.
Well, we had a chat
all in the pursuit of this European superstate with a common currency of the euro. Now, when the euro was set up, many economists made it perfectly clear at the time that it was never going to work, and was unworkable and was never going to work. We've been through an economic crisis, and as a sage said, when the tide goes down, you kind of get to see who's not wearing a bathing suit. And what that means is that all the imperfections of the euro and the eurozone are being laid bare.
So on Monday evening on Newsnight, we had a very interesting conversation between former Tory minister John Redwood and also the Greek finance minister Giorgio Papakonstantino. So let's have a listen to that now. This is about a minute or so long, and we can discuss it afterwards, because they're talking about this very thing. What would happen if Greece did default rather than roll over another bailout?
Very briefly, sketching what would happen if you left the euro.
Well, you know, last Sunday the Greek Parliament voted on the new austerity package. If by a very large two-thirds majority, if it had voted against, then the eurozone would stop the aid program for Greece, and then in the next morning you'd have queues outside the banks, people trying to take their money out or send it out of the country. By midday, you'd have to send in the army and the police force to guard the banks and shut down the banking system. By the end of the day, we wouldn't be able to buy medicines from abroad or fuel, oil and gas, and soon we wouldn't be able to pay pensions and salaries.
John Redwood,
what would happen. I mean, okay. People talk about the exit of the euro as if it can be done in some kind of an automatic way. That's not how it works. If you're outside the eurozone, you can think about devaluing. But if you are within the eurozone, it's a one-way ticket. You don't get out. You just do the kinds of adjustments that are necessary to stay within the eurozone in a competitive way.
Right, thank you. John Redwood, what do you think would happen?
Well, if you plan it, it wouldn't be anything like that. I mean, 87 countries at least have left single currency areas since the Second World War, and we can't even remember most of them because it worked perfectly smoothly. And what actually happens is you plan it, and then on a given day you announce the whole package, and your new central bank has all the powers to protect its own banks and to print as much currency as it's going to need to honour all debts. You immediately devalue and establish a new market rate, and that cuts your debt burden and it makes you more competitive. And so from that moment onwards, you have a chance of recovery. Iceland did it, and Iceland is in a better position today than Greece that's soldiering on.
Okay, thank you both very much indeed.
Iceland was now...
That was Jeremy Paxman talking over the Greek finance minister, Giorgio Papakonstantino. Martin, let's get you to answer this one. We're talking there about, he's saying it's a one-way ticket. You can't actually default on these loans. This is what the Greek finance minister is saying.
Well, you can. I think it's actually probably more to the drastic end of the spectrum than an easy, smooth
transition.
Well,
the reason he's saying that is because he's talking about having to send the police and the army in at by lunchtime if they leave the euro.
I think Graham Turner, who's a city economist, a left-wing city economist, he's been suggesting that what we really need to think about doing is perhaps the Germany going back on the Deutschmark and allowing Southern Europe to keep the euro, which would devalue against the Deutschmark. And that might actually be acceptable to the Germans, because the original conception of the euro, the hard euro, was to have the Benelux countries, who are pretty much on the same level.
Yeah.
And the problem with the euro is it shouldn't have been extended to Southern Europe in this kind of way.
What's the point of that? What's the point of that, Martin? Because Greece is going to default anyway.
What nobody is picking up on here, the reason why they're chucking money at this and trying to, it's basically a bank bailout. We're not bailing the Greeks out. They won't see any of the money. It's going straight back to the banks. The problem is the CDO market is absolutely. You quoted Warren Buffett earlier.
This is your derivatives.
Derivatives market is essentially a time bomb ready to go off. And if Greece defaults or Portugal defaults, or even Greece isn't a very big country, but that is enough to bring the derivatives market down, which will bring down the whole banking system. The banks are basically insolvent. They've been insolvent for the last 4 years.
Now, maybe,
and we're all going through the motions of pretending they're not insolvent when they are.
Well, maybe we can carry on that conversation where Jeremy Paxman interrupted it, because Papakonstantino was then saying, hang on a minute, Iceland, and I would imagine what he was saying, Iceland wasn't in the euro, and he's making it more difficult for Greece.
And of course, what Iceland has done is repudiated its debts, which have been picked up by the British and Dutch governments, because British local authorities had a lot of money in Landsbanki and IceSave, and the British government and the Dutch government bailed out the basically British depositors, and they presented the bill to the Icelanders, who had a referendum, said we're not paying it. So that actually just goes on to Britain and Holland's deficit. So that's what the Icelanders have done, and good for them. And ultimately, we are going to have to face the fact that the banks are insolvent, and what should be happening is we should be basically breaking up the existing banking system. I believe in nationalising the banking system, basically, but if you don't want to do that, you've still got to break up the too big to fail banks, but they're too politically powerful, and the politicians are now, you see, democracy is now on the line in Greece. And they don't forget, they had a military dictatorship in the 60s and the 70s, and they were occupied by the Germans during the war. So, of course, this is creating a lot of bitterness in Greece. They didn't pay any compensation for all the thousands of Greeks that died and everything that happened during the war. Germany was let off its debts in 1952 by the British and the Americans. So there's a real danger here that we're getting into a 1930s-style beggar-thy-neighbour hostility scenario. And I actually agree with what you said. I agree with what you say. I think they've got to default. They will default. But it will actually be fairly traumatic.
Well, we're joined both by William Dartmouth, who's UKIP MEP. Would you say, William, that there is a solution to this crisis? And if so, what would you like to see happen?
Sorry, which crisis?
We're talking about the Greek crisis. As it's being rolled over and rolled over again and again. Clearly, hundreds of thousands of public employees don't want to be sacked, and it's not good for the country if that happens.
They're not going to pay their debts by doing this.
There's no pain-free solution, but the least painful solution would be, contrary to what Michael said with respect, would be for Greece to leave the Eurozone, devalue and reinstitute the drachma. Now I would make the point that we just heard on the clip John Redwood saying 87 countries have left a monetary union since the Second World War. Unfortunately, I can't reel off all 87, but what I can perhaps remind you, and I see that Michael here, no one can see him, Michael is perhaps will perhaps remember too, is that there used to be a monetary union between Ireland and the UK. I can't tell you exactly when it stopped, but it did stop, and relatively painlessly, and it's perfectly, there's no technical reason to switch. It's simply announced at midnight on a Friday. There's a bank holiday on a Monday, or they say there's two bank holidays on Monday and Tuesday, and the changeover happens then.
So we should be watching out for the next bank holiday in Greece.
Yes, but the problem is that the derivatives market, the shadow banking market, is a factor in play here. And the other 87 currency unions, people come out of currency unions all the time, people defaulted all the time. But once you've got a shadow banking market, which, as Warren Buffett said, is weapons of financial mass destruction, the reason why they're rushing around trying to prop it all up is because if a country like Greece defaults, all these CDOs then get, you see, they'll have voluntary haircuts, because if they go into default, all of these contracts then come online, and they are actually fraudulent insurance contracts, which will not be
fair enough. But I mean, perhaps the status of the banks is the topic a little bit later on, but I must make the point that what is clear is that the Eurozone doesn't work.
No.
The concept was flawed, but let's not forget the fact that the establishment politicians in this country all wanted Britain to go into the Euro.
Apart from Gordon Brown, of course.
Apart from Gordon Brown, and he kept us out of the Euro. Yeah. Tony Blair wanted to, Paddy Ashton wanted to, yeah. Nick Clegg still wants to, despite all the available thing.
Evidence.
John Major doesn't want to, and I joined the UK Independence Party much later than I should have done in life, and it's comparatively humbling thought for me, and perhaps it's relevant for others to say that if it hadn't been for the UK Independence Party and others, who also took the disdain of the establishment, Britain would be in the Euro now, which, as the chap described, as the Greek finance minister said, he said it's a one-way ticket, or, as it's also been described, the Eurozone is basically a burning building with no exits. And if the establishment politicians had had their way, Britain would be in the Eurozone now. And however bad things are, it would be much, 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 much worse.
I think that's right. And I think there was a big fight between Gordon Brown and Tony Blair exactly on this issue. And Brown won.
And Brian, what?
Okay, well, from Brussels and the Eurozone to Westminster and Downing Street, because this week there was a big summit on Monday with Andrew Lansley and the Health Secretary and David Cameron, the Prime Minister, in attendance. But there was a little bit of a problem for Andrew Lansley as he arrived. His way was blocked by a 75-year-old National Health Service health campaigner, June Hortalt. And let's have a look, listen now to that little confrontation outside Downing Street.
You can wait, people are waiting for a bed now.
I promise you.
And when it goes private,
He's gutless, he's a coward, and he's got no conscience. They only look at the few who didn't vote against it, not the majority who vote against, always the few. They only look at the few because they know the majority are against them. So they never invite the majority, only their little few.
This 75-year-old lady, June Martin, is just one person, but she did stand right in the way there. In a way, she was symbolising, I suppose, the anger of many medical professionals from the professional organisations that were excluded on Monday.
Well, I suppose so. I mean, I don't really know what David Cameron thought he was going to achieve by inviting people who agreed with him anyway. I understand. I've seen a minute of the actual meeting, and the people he invited all criticised the bill as well in the meeting. He wanted them to just say how they would implement it, but they all lined up to say we're not happy with this bit, this, that and the other aspect of the bill. So even the people he invited were not actually on board.
William Dartmouth, UKIP MEP, what are your thoughts about what the direction that the health service seems to be taking under the LibCon alliance, because or coalition, because this is something that we were promised wasn't going to happen before the election?
Well, I mean, I think it's very worrying for people, but I think I must make the point that as usual, The EU has its bad effects almost everywhere, and one of the areas in which the EU has a bad effect is the National Health Service, because the working time directive is something that makes it increasingly difficult and more expensive to give 24-hour medical coverage. But I think I have to say that the late, great Barbara Castle, I don't know if anybody here remembers her, or any of your listeners remember her.
Yes, I'll admit her.
The late, great Barbara Castle said, when she was Secretary of State for Health, that the British taxpayer wants value for money. And what is important is that the money that is spent in the National Health Service goes preponderantly towards patient care and not preponderantly towards, frankly, bureaucrats.
This is one of the criticisms, of course, of this legislation. It's going to have a whole new tier of bureaucracy into the health service.
I know. Well, as I said earlier on, I think it's very, very worrying. I think it's very, very worrying indeed.
Now,
but I would say that if we weren't subject to the Working Time Directive, it would make it much more straightforward, as well as less expensive, to provide 24-hour medical coverage, which, of course, what is needed and required from the NHS.
Now we're joined by Marina Morris. Hi, Marina.
Hello. Talking about health in its 2010 manifesto, the Conservative Party promised to give patients more choice, trust healthcare professionals, increase access to vital drugs and services, take control of your care, a healthier nation. It promises to provide a budget for the healthcare needs and social care for people with a chronic illness or a long-term condition. But what if this budget is insufficient or needs change? For most of us, under the new health proposals, our health budget will be held by our GP. He will pull our budgets, allocating our communal resources to the greatest need. The healthy on his list will subsidize the sick. Patients could be put in competition with other sick patients, trying to shout the loudest for the piece of the budget. GPs might not want to accept or retain high-cost patients. A GP with a budget to balance can refer for expensive treatments, tests, or so on, or not. healthcare based on needs, but rationed by raising or lowering the bar of needs to fit the funding. Patients on GPs, this many seriously ill patients, potentially receiving second-rate care or trying to move to GPs, this healthier or perhaps younger patients. Health inequality magnified by pooling resources as far lower level than the soon-to-be defunct primary care trust. At another level, what happens if your local hospital isn't the cheapest to provide the service you need? Or what will happen if your local hospital loses money in his new competitive world? Will budget be diverted from GPs, or could your local hospital face closure? Locally, the North Bristol Trust is still using about 6% of current year budget intended for the health of the Bristol population to repay old debts. The doctors' organization, the BMA, is calling on the House of Lords to reject the healthcare bill, but it looks as if the House of Commons will force the bill through regardless. The Prime Minister is now only discussing implementation of this healthcare organization who support these proposals, excluding those who warn that the government's market solution will damage the NHS. The government has promised to trust healthcare professionals. Why is it ignoring doctors?
Well, that's a good question, Marina. Yes, it's a good question. Yes.
It sounded a bit more like a speech to
me,
actually.
Yes, but why are they? Why are they ignoring doctors, do you think? Because clearly the professionals have said they don't want this bill. They've had enough of it. This is not just the doctors. This is all sorts of other areas of medicine. So how have we come to this?
Despite my Oxford accent, I didn't actually vote for the Conservatives in the last election, which won't surprise you. I voted for the UK Independence Party, and I worked very hard for the UK Independence Party in the last election, and I have the honour to have been elected for the UK Independence Party. So what the Conservatives propose is really a matter for them. And I think,
but how has it come
to
this?
I think you need to ask a representative of the Conservative Party to explain the rationalisation.
I mean, do you think
this.
That there's a line that the Conservatives should have drawn about what gets privatised and what doesn't? Or is there, is
well,
there anything
I think,
go?
With respect, I think that's a slightly loaded question. I think the thing is this. The NHS is a jewel in the crown of the UK and UK society. And the society that we all of us have created here. And when the history books come to be written in the middle of the 21st century, it will be looked on as a beacon of and a shining example of what we in Britain can do and have achieved. Now, I'm not Secretary of State for Health. It's not my aspiration to be Secretary of State for Health. Indeed, just for the record, I'm UK Independence Party national spokesman on trade. But I think I would say that anybody who's Secretary of State for Health, of whichever party or parties, is obviously concerned that the very, very large sums of money are spent represent value for money and also are properly directed towards patients. And that is the thing. Now, the other thing is, which I must correct, if I may, the charming lady who just made one of the longest questions I've ever heard in my life. Actually,
it's an article rather.
It's a report.
It's an article. Yeah, it's a report. I was told it was.
Okay, you can do that as long as you do it quickly.
I'll just say that if it's Andrew Lansley or if it's Jack Straw or whoever it is, these politicians who are Secretary of State for Health are not trying to destroy the health service. They're just trying to do their best according to their own criteria.
Well, isn't that according to the criteria?
Even though they aren't parties, and I say this, even though they aren't members of the party, don't support the
but
party.
But aren't they acting in the interests of possibly even foreign health private healthcare companies?
No, I don't think. I generally think they're trying to do their best. But perhaps we can agree to disagree on that one.
Okay. Before we hear Martin's reaction to this health story, let's have a listen to Prime Minister's questions, where Ed Miliband, the Labour leader, questioned David Cameron on this very topic.
Ed Miliband. Mr. Speaker, nobody believes him and nobody trusts him on the health service. Now, at the Homerton Hospital on Monday,
I met with senior staff working in HIV services who explained to me how this bill will fragment and disrupt services. The health secretary should be quiet and listen to the people who work in the health service. He should calm down, Mr. Speaker. They explained that HIV treatment is currently commissioned by one organisation, the Primary Care Trust. Under his plans, treatment will be commissioned by three organisations: the National Commissioning Board, the Clinical Commissioning Group, and the Health and Wellbeing Board. They said to me it will damage the world-class service they provide for patients. Now, why won't he listen to the people who actually know what they're talking about in the NHS?
But if the Right Honourable Gentleman is opposing other organisations that have expertise in AIDS and AIDS treatment taking part in the NHS, he'll be opposing the Terence Higgins Trust, who do an enormous amount to support HIV. The fact is, what we can see, Mr. Speaker, is complete opportunism from the party opposite. They used to back choice. They used to back the independent sector. They used to back reform. I say to you, Mr. Speaker, you don't save the NHS by opposing reform. You save the NHS by delivering reform.
Well, what I'd like to comment on in relation to this, and it's a kind of European point, if you like, one of the implications of Lansley's bill is that the private sector will be allowed, any willing provider will be allowed to bid for national health contracts. Now, once you've done that, according to European competition law, European competition law kicks in. While the National Health Service remains a ring-fenced state-provided service, the competition law can't be utilised. But once you've actually brought the private sector in, then private sector providers who don't win a contract when they put in a lower bid will be able to take you to court to force your GP to take the lower contract, the lower bid that they're putting in. And the private healthcare companies, mainly US companies, will come in and put in the lowest bids. And if they don't get the contracts, they'll then take you to court, and then they'll get the contracts, and then, of course, the money starts being spent. The British National Health Service is not the best in the world, but by God, it's the cheapest. It's the most efficient way to provide a national health service, and that's Britain's the only country in the world who's got it.
But Martin, the whole argument of this bill is that actually there's loads of private healthcare providers that can come and do it much more efficiently and cheaply.
Well, that's just ideology. There's no evidence for that whatsoever, frankly.
Okay, well, let's move on and talk about a different subject, and that is to do with the mayors. This is great. An article from the Bristol Evening Post. Great cities were built by local leaders, not by government, says the Prime Minister. And that's David Cameron, who is urging the people of Bristol to vote yes to adopt the city's first elected mayor. And this came up again at question time, where our local MP, Charlotte Leslie, Conservative, brought another question in the House of Commons.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Does the Prime Minister agree that an elected mayor, more power for cities, including over local railway infrastructure, presents a great opportunity for those of us in Bristol who've been long campaigning for a resurrection of local rail, including a Henbury loop line around the north of the city?
Yeah. Well, I do support having elected mayors in our great cities. Obviously, it is going to be for those cities themselves to choose. I'm hugely encouraged by what has happened in Liverpool recently. We'll be having these referenda, and people in Bristol will have the chance to make that choice. But at the same time, what people I think haven't entirely noticed is the government is going through a huge act of devolution to cities in terms of the powers and the money that we're prepared to offer them so that they can build their own futures. If you think of how Bristol, Leeds, Manchester, Liverpool, Birmingham, how these great cities actually built themselves up in the first place, it wasn't on order and instruction from London. It was the great city figures that did that for them. We want that again.
That was David Cameron speaking in the House of Commons this week at Prime Minister's Question Time on the topic of mayors, in answer to Charlotte Leslie, the Conservative MP, Bristol Conservative MP's question. Now, William Dartmouth, you're a UKIP MEP. Can you just give us an idea what you think of this whole idea of having mayors? The idea we're being sold, anyway, is that one specific individual, if they have a bit more power in the city, can make a difference. I mean, Charlotte's there talking about opening up our local railways, David Cameron's invoking the sort of spirit of the empire. You know, when Bristol was growing, that was a time where it was local leaders that were leading things.
Well, we're very much in favour of this. The concept is not so much mayors. There have been mayors for a long time. The concept is having elected executive mayors in the same way that they do in the United States. And I think there's a lot to be said for having some specific person who's actually accountable. But there's two other quick points I'd like to make on this. One is that the other great thing about having elected mayors is that there's a tendency here that the establishment party duopoly or triopoly, whatever it's called, is actually being undermined. You will remember that Ken Livingstone got elected in London as an independent, rather amazingly. I didn't vote for him, I have to say, but I nonetheless applaud the fact that he got elected. And there have been other examples, not least in Doncaster is another one, of people who are not members of the major parties getting elected, and that's a very good thing.
But we had a big the
other quick point which I have to make is that, look, here is the Prime Minister. He's giving the people of Bristol a referendum on whether there should be a mayor, an elected mayor of Bristol, but he's not prepared to give the people of Bristol a referendum either on the Lisbon Treaty or on an in-out referendum on the European Union.
Now, there was a debate on this.
And I've got to make that point, please.
You certainly have. There was a debate this week at the Council House here in Bristol on the elected mayor, and the Bristol Evening Post reported on that on the 23rd. The initial vote, there was a straw poll taken at the meeting. The initial vote saw 41% of the people there saying yes to an elected mayor for Bristol, 12% saying no, and 47% undecided. We're hoping that during the course of the discussions, the undecided went down, not up. So anyway, then the four guest speakers set out their cases: architect and tobacco factory founder and merchant venturer George Ferguson and Conservative Deputy Leader Mark Weston were in favour, whilst Council and Liberal Democrat Leader Barbara Jank and Management Consultant Deborah Hallett were against. After they spoke, a second vote saw the no's rise dramatically. 38% were in favour, compared to 41% before. 29% were against, compared to 12% at the beginning of the debate, and 32% were still undecided. So at least that figure of undecided went down during the discussions. That's definitely a positive sign. By the end of the debate, 47% said yes, 36% said no, and 17% were undecided. Martin, certainly seems that after the discussion, people were less in favour of the mayor than they were beforehand. What's your view?
Well, I'm opposed to this, I suppose. I'm not very happy about elected mayors. The problem is you're going to get a kind of personalisation of politics, and it's all very well talking about having people outside the main political parties standing, but you can end up with celebrity driven.
But we're voting for people when we vote, aren't we?
We are. I mean, if it goes through and we end up with an elected mayor, then obviously the Labour Party will contest those places. I mean, we've contested the London mayor. Ken Livingstone was opposed to there being a mayor, but once there was a mayor, he stood for to be it.
And got elected as an independent.
That was a tremendous achievement by him. And of course, he then had to be readmitted to the Labour Party, because he had the support on the ground. And if you think back to the 19th century, you had big political leaders in big cities like Birmingham, Joe Chamberlain, the unionist liberal, and he and municipal socialism. You know, the Labour Party cut its teeth by, creating local gas and water, municipally owned services, and so on. And that's where the locus of power lay. And I'm in favour of localisation, but also you do have to have an overall, basically central government in this country is trusted more than local government. It's the centralised bureaucracy is more efficient and professional, and that's how most people perceive it.
But surely that's actually an argument for having executive mayors.
I suppose it is.
Martin, if you just argued yourself into
a hole. No, I'm just saying I basically prefer politics to be political. That is to say, we have committees that decide things, not just individuals and charismatic leaders. On the other hand, if it comes through and there are elected mayors, then they will have to be contested.
Now, the other thing that's going along in parallel with this is the idea of elected police commissioners. So,
I'm totally opposed to that.
What are your thoughts on that, William, from UKIP MEP?
Well, Well, the real person to answer this is my distinguished colleague, Trevor Coleman, who was also elected as a UKIP MEP, who was a former police superintendent and served in the police, starting off from the ranks and served in the police for 33 years.
Well, he was from Devon and Cornwall, I think, and he also was involved in Operation Countryman, investigating corruption in the Metropolitan Police. He could be quite a valuable guy to have around at the moment, actually.
Exactly. Well, I was thinking that. Public accountability is a very good thing, so that's a plus for that. But then politicisation of the police is a very bad thing, and that's a minus for that. So I think it needs a lot of thinking about whether or not there should be elected police commissioners.
I mean, at the moment, we've got what's called a police authority, which takes individual members plus some lay members from all over the area. And I mean, we've got Avon and Somerset Police here, which has got a very concentrated in the city with hundreds of thousands of people all in one place. And then we've got Somerset, which is all spread out. The idea that one person can look after all those interests is not necessarily...
Well, that's why it's a bit of a problem. But yeah, on the other hand, public accountability with one person, and I've got to disagree with my distinguished colleague here, is that accountability is very important. Actually, accountability is vital in the way that we're governed. And if it's focused on one person, it does make accountability much easier. Look, we've just been talking about the NHS, and you've been talking about Andrew Lansley and David Cameron. It'd be much more difficult to talk in the terms that we have if you were just talking about a committee of 25.
But it's also a problem, isn't it, if that one person is corrupt?
For example,
our chief constable has been referred to in the House of Commons as corrupt. Colin Port for having his... I mean, the only reason we can say that is because
that
this is under parliamentary privilege, because he used his wife to actually project manage the privatisation of the police civilian support services. So if you have one person, they are also maybe, possibly... open to corruption. Anyway, on to our final story. David Cameron's family champion, Emma Harrison, has quit this week after a police probe. The advisor hired by David Cameron to get 120,000 problem families back to work has resigned after a week of mounting allegations about her firm. The arrests of four former employees and criticism of the £8.6 million dividend she was paid last year. Now she's also been arrested, Martin.
Well, I mean, this is basically corporate welfare. We've got private companies in this country, like A4E, which are basically, virtually all of their business comes from the government. They are effectively civil servants, but they're being paid six. You know, they're getting £6 million a year. It's the same with the banks that we own. The amount of money being paid out there, if the rest of the civil service has to settle for £100,000. That's it. You know, but. You don't solve problems by... I mean, most social problems are actually pretty intractable. And, you know, you need competent people to manage dealing with them. And you don't solve problems by just shifting deck chairs around or privatising this or nationalising that. It's actually, you know, most of
but
the problems...
But this was
are,
simply
are,
about getting people back to work. And there was certainly... There were at least was... the story was that Emma was one of the best people in the country at it.
Well, I mean, I know that people in the work programme and the people bidding for work in the work programme will not get paid unless they place people in full-time jobs. Now, as we go into the crash, because that's what's going to happen when Greece defaults and the banks go down, there's going to be a crash, a real crash. We're going to have mass unemployment of a far, far higher level than we've got now, and A4E will not get people into work, and therefore, according to their existing contracts, they won't be paid. Then they'll go bust, and then we'll go, what are we going to do about it? And then the government will have to step in. That's what usually happens.
William, what are your thoughts?
I'd like to make a slightly different point. I'm not saying this in any ad hominem way, but most of the contracts from which this company has benefited from were given out under the last Labour
absolutely
government.
They opened the door to
and,
this.
But also this lady seems to have impressed David Cameron. And it does seem to me in the 21st century Britain that there's a certain kind of person who's sort of master the jargon with a bit of charisma, who impresses politicians. Mm. And I put Stephen Hester in that category as well. Stephen Hester obviously impressed Alistair Darling, who appointed him, and seems to impress Cameron Osborne as well. And I think that we taxpayers and we voters and we Brits need to really watch out for that kind of person because they do seem to be a lot of them around.
Well, more than there should be.
Ross Perot in the United States made all of his money selling computer systems to the welfare system, and that's how he became a multimillionaire.
Martin, just finally, I mean, we've had the announcement from RBS and Lloyd's, massive losses again. What's going to happen there, just really briefly?
Because the banking system is broken. That's what I said earlier.
News this week certainly does point towards that. Well, anyway, that's all for our guest this week, MEP from the UK Independence Party, William Dartmouth. After the news, the misdiagnosis scandal at University Hospitals Bristol NHS Trust. See you then.
This is BCFM 93.2, the community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News.